Hi there, I'm Dan McGowan. I'm a clean comedian with a passion for raising the bar on clean comedy. This podcast is all about clean comedy, and I'll be interviewing clean comedians and entertainers, and we'll find out what makes them tick.
Or what ticks them off.
So if you want to learn more about clean comedy, stick around, because this is Just Pure Laughs. Well, joining me today on this podcast is a longtime friend, great guy, very creative. I was going to read his resume here, but, you know, it would take our entire podcast to just go through all the stuff he's done. But let me give you some nuts and bolts here. Manier Wilson is one of the leading forces for creativity in all facets of corporate and personal life. He's a CEO, Chief Encouragement Officer, which I love, of the Assume Brilliance Group with tons of clients. He'll talk about that maybe. And he worked for Walt Disney Imagineering. He was in charge of helping get many rides and attractions going, like the Tower of Terror. And I shudder even saying those words. And he's done a lot of great things. He's a published author. He's a speaking coach. He's been involved in the Dramatists Guild. He's been involved in theater. He's traveled the world. And it's all fantastic. He likes to brag that he hangs his hat collection, which is over 214 different hats in Colorado's Front Range. So, McNair, it's great to have you on this podcast with me today. I hope you're having a good day so far.
I am, Dan, but that's going to change real quick.
Whatever I can do to make your life more miserable. That's good.
People would say to my dad, have a nice day. And he'd say, I've made other plans.
Yeah, it's good. I like that. So, man, your career. I mean, I knew you from a long time ago. And then I remember us having a great conversation at that incredible breakfast place. Snooze, right? Was that the name of it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The best.
And I really miss that place. I mean, all we have out here is McDonald's, you know, Egg McMuffin. It doesn't really compare to Snooze, but I mean, nothing really does. That was a great place. But so that's the last time I think we actually talked face to face. But it's been so great to follow you. Your inspiring quotes. I know you've written books. So what should we talk about today, McNair? You want to talk about your book at that out of the gate? Your what's your new book? A Trombone Played Badly. Did I get that name right?
Yes. It's a sequel to my last book, which was Hatch. Hatch was my fifth published book. And Hatch was Brainstorming Secrets of a Theme Park Designer is the subtitle. And just briefly, when I got to Imagineering, first as a consultant, I had a street theater company that was doing 30 Renaissance festivals a year. And my partner, Herb Hansen, and I, and we were invited to be at Italy, Epcot, for 3 months for three months of Epcot, 10 shows a day. And a week after Epcot opened, it was so popular among cast members and guests. They said, do you have any more people? We said, look, we do 30 Renaissance festivals a year. And during the height of the season, late summer, early fall, we do five or six festivals simultaneously, which is 6 or 8 or 10 people in each of those cities. So yeah, we've got more people. So by Thanksgiving, having opened October 2nd at Epcot, by Thanksgiving, we added a troupe to the United Kingdom, doing 12 shows a day in each of those countries. And by the summer of 85, we were doing 45 shows throughout wow. Epcot in five different places. And the Imagineers, when they found out we were not a Disney group, and they suspected that because of our sarcasm and our touching guests and all these non-Disney things, you know, it was audience participation. And so they invited us out to Epcot, out to Imagineering for a week, which is in Glendale next to Pasadena. That's kind of ground zero for all things Imagineering. And
that's where I grew up. I grew up in Glendale.
Well, that's your problem.
Yes. That's many people have asked, but that's what it is. I grew up in Glendale. And
I grew up in Pasadena. Yeah. We probably should have known each other.
We should have.
Yeah. But like the second or third day at Imagineering, they asked us if we would be available to come out once a month for a week. And we said, well, we don't think we could release two of the, you know, executive directors of a company that, you know, for 25% of the time. So the arrangement was once a month, one of us would come and bring someone else from our company that we thought would fit into the free for all of Imagineering. And, they they put out a memo that that we would be available, that the company would pay for it, so they did no project had to worry about, you know, paying for our time. And so I'd come out 1 month with somebody and Herbie the next month, and then the third month in the cycle we would come together. So in a 3 month cycle, I would spend 2 weeks at Imagineering, and very quickly we got tied into a lot of projects there that they were starting, one of which became the Disney MGM Studios, now the Disney Hollywood Studios, which is not a name, it's like a subtitle for a book. I'm always working with authors who've got a title for their book that's a subtitle. The subtitle explains the book. The title gets your attention. Hatch. Yeah. What the heck does that mean?
Yeah.
Like one of my friends, you know, just when you think your friends have an IQ that's measurable, other than on the thermometer, on the thermostat in your wall, you know, a friend says, well, why is there a chicken on the cover of your book? I said, where's the chicken? Well, it's right there on Hatch. I said, oh, really? Chicken, Hatch? Hatch an egg, hatch a plan, hatch an idea. Oh, that makes sense. I said, but not to you. but Imagineering didn't have a formalized system of brainstorming. And they noticed that any team I was on, even that first week, whether I led the team or just sat in the room, we got to a lot of ideas quickly and big ideas. And they said, you have a system. I said, yes, it's a combination of infant sacrifice and standing waist deep in tapioca. And they pulled their pen out and said, how do you spell tapioca? and so I began teaching my system, which I just call generically the seven agreements of brainstorming. Any group of people who will agree to play well with each other using these agreements.
You know, I love that whole, I work as a comedian, and I work with a lot of comedians. And one of the things I see over and over again is a deficiency in what you just said, a deficiency in being able to work together towards a common, whatever that common thing is, whether it's a joke or a show that you want to put on or whatever it is, because there tends to be so much ego involved where if it's not my idea, then, you know, we're not going to pursue it. So it sounds like you're saying, I'm sure there was some ego involved, but everybody learned how to work together, to work together on these plans.
Well, Walt Disney said, it's amazing what you can get done if you don't care who gets the credit.
Wow. I love that. Yeah.
And that's why forever, for years, until Walt died and for many years after that, any artwork that was done at Imagineering had no one's initials or signature on it. Now, of course, Imagineers being Imagineers, they figured out ways to put them on there. The famous 1958 map of Disneyland, the best map ever done by Sam McKim. There are whole websites dedicated to showing you where Sam put his initials.
Where would he put his initials?
If you get that map and you look by the big banner that says Disneyland, his initials are in the leaves of the trees right there where Grand Canyon diorama is. My first office at Imagineering was Sam's old office. I met him before he retired, and then they gave me his office. And I had brought back on my second trip to Imagineering, because I met him on that first trip, brought back my map that I bought in 1957 when our family first met there. We moved from Minnesota in 57. And I said, would you sign this? And he was just the most humble guy. He did most of of the artwork that became Frontierland, because he was kind of a Western art guy.
Oh, wow.
And he just was very, very low-key. He was Seventh-day Adventist, devout Christian, Seventh-day Adventist. And his son still works there. His son was my intern in 1989, maybe. And he's now still there full time. Just great, great, great guy. And so because I got Sam to sign that, then over the years, as I met the other Imagineers who worked there, and in those days, when you bought the map, it was on heavy, heavy archival paper, and you could get it rolled or folded. And I thought, folded? Why don't you just hand it to me in ashes? I mean, so I have it. It's never been folded. I sprung for the extra 10 cents for the cardboard tube to carry it home in. It's now been signed by 20-some old Imagineers who worked on Disneyland. And I asked one of the top guys in the whole Disneyana collecting business, I forget his first name, his last name is Sears, but he does these huge auctions. And I said, what would something like this be worth? And I sent him a picture. And he said, it literally is priceless. the only way to put a value on it would be to auction it, and whatever it sells for, that's what it's worth on that day.
But, oh, how interesting.
But yeah. He guessed it would have been tens of thousands of dollars. He said, are you interested in auctioning it? And I said, not a bit.
And no, said, that's like a priceless, literally a priceless item that you want to hang on to, right? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it's like having a pair of walled socks or something. So everybody said, when are you going to do a book? When are you going to do a book? When are you going to do a book? So I started teaching this, brainstorming secrets. And here's, you talked about the problem of people trying to brainstorm. The second agreement of brainstorming is, I call it separate two eggs. And it's simply to divide the activities of creative thinking from critical thinking. Creative thinking is idea generation. If we've got an hour, we will spend 40 minutes on that, maybe 45. Just what's the plan? Throw out any idea. And then critical thinking is agreement number seven, which is basically deciding. But everybody wants to do number seven first. You have an idea, and the bonehead across the table from you says, that won't work. What's that going to cost? We tried that last year, but you know, it's like, shut the blank up.
Right. Well, how does a meeting like that even work? Somebody has to be the main guy, right? The buck stops here guy.
Agreement number one is start a fire. And that is, you send out a memo or a notes or whatever you can ahead of time saying, we're going to have our first session on this. And so start thinking about, this is the subject. So come with ideas, come with posters, come with drawings, come with anything pushing in that direction. And for example, when I was asked to come up with something, you know, before it opened, we knew that Disney MGM Studios was going to be too small.
Hmm.
Even though the average attraction was longer than in any park. If you, opening day of that park, if you went on every attraction, you would have a full day. But people say, well, there's only five rides. Well, that's why we don't call them rides.
Oh, they're attractions, right? Yeah, not rides.
Is Great Moments with Mr. Yeah. Lincoln a ride?
Right, no.
Is the great is Monster Sound Show a ride? I mean, you got people on stage doing the sound effects to a movie that they're watching, and so on and so on and so on. So there's a reason for that. Now, my boss, Marty Sklar, who was a writer, he's the one that told Walt, call them attractions, because a lot of what we're going to build will not be rides.
Yeah.
So you start with getting people's attention. And I would go when I was assigned by Michael Eisner to come up with something for the far end of the extension, when we were going to, before Disney MGM Studios opened, we needed to expand it. Well, we couldn't add a land because of the way it was laid out. When they did Star Wars, they had to plop it behind the railroad tracks, literally outside of Disneyland's 89 acres, as they did with Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones was called Project P because it was going to be built in the Pluto parking lot.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. And people, what is Project P? He said, get your team together that did the airplane ride with the movie Airplane. Do you like Gladiator movies?
Right. Yeah.
Well, we designed an attraction based on that, which everybody loved, but it was too expensive and a little on the PG or heading into R rated side.
Right.
To be true to the movie. And so I got that team together called the Knuckleheads, and I went and met with each one of those five or six guys in advance and say, we got to put something at the far end of Sunset Boulevard is going to be the extension. So you get to the end of Hollywood Boulevard, you're standing in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater, and there's a parallel line or perpendicular line that goes all the way off to the eastward. Well, when you do a new a land or a new area, you need a mall, you expand a mall, you need an anchor store. So you need a Nordstrom, a Sears, a JCPenney's, or whatever.
Right, yeah.
And in Disney, they're called the weenie.
The what? The weenie? Like
the weenie.
Oh, weenie.
And it gets people's attention.
Yeah.
And that came from Walt would come home from work, and his little dog would meet him at the back door, and he'd go to the fridge and get a hot dog, put it in his hand, hold it to his hand, and shake it. And it would hold the dog's attention as Walt went to his bedroom, put on his work clothes, went outside, and started working on his backyard railroad, and then the dog would get the weenie.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So The weenie is to get people's attention.
Yeah.
Everybody's heard that thing. Like, what's the weenie? What's the weenie? But they never, nobody ever tells people, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And so I had to put together a team for the, to design the weenie for the far end of Sunset Boulevard. Well, we had designed an attraction, a ride that we never put into Disney MGM Studios. I said, well, people said, well, we can put it down there. And I said, but it's not a weenie, it's a box. And that was Rock and Roller Coaster.
Oh, okay. Wow.
But that didn't get people's attention. So that's when Eisner said, well, I've got a friend I want you guys to work with. I'll bring him over. Well, usually that was going to be a young up-and-coming screenwriter or film director. You know, we went through a lot of those guys. And some of them were, you know, really good, talented men and women. So we're in our boss, Marty Sklar's little conference room, which comfortably holds less than a dozen people. And Michael, 6'3", walks in with his little friend, 5'5", Mel Brooks.
Oh, my gosh.
And we all agreed later that from that moment on, every day the rest of our lives could only be the second best day of our lives. We shared oxygen with Melvin Kaminsky. And he was everything you want him to be. He was brilliant. He was hilarious. And he, you know, he said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, we're going to build an attraction that's going to be the something, 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 or the Mel Brooks something, 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 something. And he said, are you spelling something with a G? And I said, I'm not. He said, good. And he was just very alert.
Yeah.
Oh, we went around. I said, now, what do we call you, Mr. Brooks? And he said, call me Mel, with his arms outstretched, like, here I am. So I said, guys, and everybody went, Mel. And from then on, whether or not he was in the room, and it, whenever you said his name, you had to stretch out your arms like, Mel.
Stretch out your arms.
Yeah,
that's
he
great.
Was there, go, yeah. Hey, Mel, I have a question. Well, he came over to me and he started pounding on my chest because I always wore a sport coat or a safari jacket of some sort because it had pockets because you didn't want to be the nerd that walked around with a briefcase. So I had pockets full of felt pens. And so I'd taken that off and he came over to me and he couldn't see my name tag after he'd met everybody else in the team. And he said, what about you? And I said, oh, you'll have to call me Mr. Wilson, which he did forever.
Oh, that's great. That is great.
In fact, I left Imagineering in the early 90s. Mid-90s, I'm in New York, and I had seen a preview of The Producers before it opened. And I was still there the week it opened, and I was sitting in my favorite restaurant that all of the actors and so on and how Broadway go to, called Charlie's on 44th Street, or is it 46th? Doesn't matter. I could look it up. It's in one of my books. And there was a commotion at the door, and Nathan Lane walked in with his retinue of friends. It was after the show. And then Matthew Broderick with his retinue of friends. And Nathan Lane's friends included Bette Midler. So the place just got quite lively. And it wasn't unusual for celebrities to be there, especially if they were on Broadway. And then all of a sudden, it was even more of a commotion at the door. And I said, oh, dear God, let it be Mel. And it was.
Wow.
And they ushered him back to the owner's table by the kitchen, which is at the very back. And the only reason to go there is if you're sitting there, so they kind of don't let people go back there and so on. And he was there, his wife and friends. And his wife, you know, was the actress Anne Bancroft,
yes.
Mrs. Robinson from The
Graduate. Oh, yeah.
And I'd had a crush on her since the invention of the crush. And so at one point I thought, well, he'll come by my table. And so he got up to go see the other guys. And I stood up and I said, Mel, with my arms outstretched. And he put his hands on my face and he started slapping my cheeks. I know this face. I know this face. And I said, Imagineering. And he said, Mr. Wilson.
Oh, that's so great.
Now, it had been 3 or 4 years since we'd seen each other. But he remembered. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I saw your show. What did you think? I said, meh. And he just laughed huge. He has a great, his own personal authentic laugh is a standing ovation of laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, come and meet the little lady. Well,
I
got so nervous.
Yeah.
So we go back. He puts his arm in my arm and we go marching back to his table. And he says, Annie? She says, what have we here? And she's very New York,
yeah.
You know. He says, Annie, this is Mr. Wilson. She says, the Imagineering, Mr. Wilson?
Oh, my goodness.
I said, yes, ma'am. He said, oh. She said, let me tell you. And she put her hand on my arm. She said, he never had better days in his life back then than those days he would spend with you boys over at Imagineering. And I said, ma'am, we loved having him. But to tell you the truth, The only reason I was ever nice to him is I thought one day I might get to meet you. She grabbed my shirt, pulled me down and said, sit down, sailor, and gave me a big kiss on the cheek.
Oh, my goodness. Look at that. Wow. Your crush came through. Yeah, nice.
But anyway, so, you know, we worked with him and we told him right away, we're going to do a Mel Brooks attraction. But at Disney MGM Studios, we don't do attractions that are just Disney theme park versions of some movie story. That's the Magic Kingdom. That's Snow White's Scary Adventure, Peter Pan's Flight, so on. And I was just doing the math the other day. You know, it was 50 years after Pirates of the Caribbean opened to Disneyland that they did the first movie. Johnny Depp was 4 years old when Pirates of the Caribbean opened at Disneyland. You know, and so it's if you start with Disney's third live action movie, Treasure Island, it's been over 70 years that Disney's been in the pirate business. And there's kind of two themes that run through Disney. One is pirates and one is circus stuff. Hmm. Dumbo and so on.
Yeah, Dumbo, right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we told Mel we're not going to do a movie or a ride of one of your movies as much as we'd all love to do Farting Cowboys of the Wild West. Be a very short attraction, and he'd get this big smile and so on. So what we've got to do is something that's inspired by you, which obviously means it's going to be funny. He said, are you guys funny? I said, we're hilarious. He said, but we're thinking maybe it's something scary. Maybe it's, we don't know what. He says, okay, I'll do the funny, you do the scary. Well, about our second meeting, we'd done something that was very funny. And he says, all right, you guys can do funny too. But at that point, when he says he'll do funny, we said, what do you mean? He said, you know what's funny? You know what comedy is? And he did a 20-minute, just standing there next to me, in front of the Michael and our boss, Marty, and the team. And he did like a 20-minute doctoral oral report on the nature of funny.
Hmm.
Dan, if I would have recorded that, I'd be the wealthiest guy in town right now.
Well, and I got to tell you, I miss that. I grew up on classic comedy and all that, and I miss when I watch comedians now and today, and when I see what's happening. So much of it is just, how can I get through this so quickly? What's the shortest path to getting a sitcom? You know, and nothing wrong with that if that's your bent, but I miss sort of the heart and soul of entertainment and of comedy. And
yep.
And I just don't feel like it's where it was before. I know that sounds like get off my lawn, but that's how I feel, you know?
No, I just watched Jim Gaffigan's new
his Hulu special. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's just this guy, you know, who, and in this he says, you know, I'm a Christian, because he always does kind of funny stuff about the Bible. So,
right.
And it's just kind of him doing his take on stuff. And it's just basic, you know, garden variety, humorous look at the world. This is how a funny mind sees the world. And we don't have a lot of that.
I think you're right. I mean, one of the things I've struggled with is continuing to bring more of that to the table when I perform or when I talk with comics or teach comedy. I try to get us the basics so that at least somebody who wants to do this, do stand-up, can learn the basics. Here's how you craft a joke. You know, here's how to stand and hold a mic and blah, 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 whatever it is. I'm talking to you as this, you know, lifelong career in entertainment. I assume much of it, if not all of it, has leaned clean, you know, you're not stumbling your way through that. I mean, it's like you know what you're doing.
I think I said the word damn once on stage, and it was during a Q&A at a college, you know, and I was to make a point about that.
Right.
But
right.
To me, it's two things that make good stand up. You've got to have a personality.
Yeah.
You got to be somebody. What's your deal? And you got to have a point of view.
Yeah. On that personality, would you liken that to, say, having a hook? Or do you just mean you need to be likable? You need to be somebody that people want to watch, want to listen to, pay attention to? Or does that make sense?
Hook is the point of view.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
Personality is what's this guy's deal? I mean, like with Gaffigan, he's a dad, five kids, a wife, there's a lot of stuff that runs through. When he explains the wife, when he explains his admiration for moms in general and so on, you get why he thinks these other things.
One of the things that comes up with me a lot is people will say, and I guess they're just trying to appease me, they'll say, oh yeah, it's a lot more effort to write clean, you know? And I think, well, it's effort to write funny. If you can't write funny, I don't care if you're clean or dirty, it's not going to be funny. It's got to be.
Exactly.
It has to be funny. That's why you're doing this. You want to entertain people. It is hard.
Yeah, funny is hard.
It's a lot harder than, you know, I used to think.
What's the old line? Dying is easy, comedy is hard.
Who's that attributed to? Do you know?
Oh, I'll think of it in a minute, but
yeah.
But that's the right phrase, attributed. But so many people have said it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So let me ask you some questions. So when you were kind of starting out, did you come from a Christian home? Is that why you went down the path you went down in terms of entertainment?
Yeah, I'm a prenatal Christian. My mother ate Bible verse candies and, you know, my first words were, "For God so loved the world."
Yeah, right.
But my folks were professional educators. My dad started out in the public school system, but then we moved to California and he got involved in the Christian school system and became quite a major player. He came up with the concept for and helped start what is now the Christian Schools Association of Christian Schools International.
Wow.
They had the California Association, which he was president of off and on for quite a while. At his funeral, the man who was the first president of ACSI, who my dad put in that position, said, you know, when we were having meetings back, the old CACS, California Association of Christian Schools, said, we whether Elwood, and that's my dad's first name, they called him Wilse for Wilson, whether Wilse was on the board or just principal of one of our member schools, we didn't make a decision, not major decision, we didn't make any kind of medium-sized decisions without calling Wilse, because he would have a couple of questions for us. And that was my dad's deal about, you know, why I do brainstorming the way I do. It's not what's – everybody thinks there's a secret answer. You know, what's going to be at the end of Sunset Boulevard? There's a secret answer, a 13-story haunted hotel. Well, nobody in their 1,000 years would have thought of that, except that the head of the team to come up with the weenie for Sunset Boulevard also – was on the team that was coming up with a high-end, most expensive luxury hotel for Disney World, which was going to sit on the water out in front of Disney MGM Studios, because there was an echelon of guests at Disney World that are very, 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 very wealthy. They don't show off. They just want the nicest room that's available, because that's the level of comfort they live in day to day.
Right.
They won't get a button that says, I'm in the most expensive room at the Grand Floridian. They just are. And So we thought, well, let's build that hotel. So we were designing that hotel. I had created a thing called Deco Day, where the team drove around L.A. and went to all the great Deco buildings, the Wiltern building, so on, so on, so on. Meanwhile, on this other team, we're trying to decide, what do we do with Mel Brooks? Because the first thing we did, we said to Mel, we're going to watch all your movies. So we have this common sort of vocabulary.
Right.
And he said, well, watch them without me. Because if I watch them with you, I said, you're going to tell us all the stuff you should have done, you could have done, you didn't do. He said, exactly. he said, that's probably what it's like to go to Disneyland with you guys. I said, oh, yeah, you'd hate it.
Yeah,
he said,
right.
Well, I think I wouldn't hate it. But
and
I try not, you know, when I'm speaking at a professional gathering, Disney World or Disneyland, I mean, I can do it at Paris or Tokyo, it just hasn't come up yet. I do my Behind the Dreams tour and I take people on a day through the park. And I tell about one of those in the new book where I took a group of professors from Azusa Pacific and I was speaking at a conference for Christian college professors. And one of the VPs is an old friend, Carolyn, says, I'm going to take my guys. We're going to play hooky and you're going to take us on your tour of Disneyland. Well, we get to illustrate one of my points to them. We get to Pirates of the Caribbean and they have the new Pirates Bridge in with the line that goes under it. And we get there and there's a sign that says wait time 45 minutes. And there's two lines. One of the lines is full of people and one of the lines is empty.
Okay.
And they look at me. I said, come on, guys. And we walk into the empty line. And they said, are you sure this is open? I said, look, pointing to the front door of the building. There's two doors. They're both open. In between them is a kid, you know, one of the lip-syncing Mormons that Disney has. And and I said, if that one on the left here, where we're going to go, or the right, whatever, if that was open, if that was closed, the door would be closed. There would be a trash can in front of it, and that kid would step over and stand in front of the trash can, and with his open hand, never with a pointed finger, say, please use this door. Please use this door. So as we're walking through this completely empty zigzag of stanchions going up to the open door, people in the other line are saying, that line's closed. I said, looks open to me. Well, that line's not, it looks open to me. We walk into the door, get inside the building, still no line. From the sign that says 45 minutes to getting on the boat was not 5 minutes.
Wow. Wow. And now, so why did that happen? Because people didn't know they could do that?
Because a line draws a line, a crowd draws a crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
And probably at one point they had both been open and they closed one. So the line for, they didn't close it. And I said to the guy, we'd up to the door. I said, oh, he goes, come on in. Welcome. Welcome. And I don't know why that kid isn't trying to say, hey folks, this line is open.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. That, yeah. That's what I was
saying. The other thing I tell people is if it says 45 minutes, it's a lie. It's probably 35 at the most. Here's the deal. If you stand in a line that says 1 hour wait, if you stand in that line for 65 minutes, you're going to complain.
Yeah.
Sign said 60 minutes. We stood in line for 65. But if you stand in that 60-minute line for 45 minutes, nobody's going to say, somebody owes my family 15 more minutes in line. In the history of theme parks and county fairs, that has never occurred.
Yeah, that's really funny. That's really funny.
They can control the line by changing the number.
Yeah. What I just thought of was a famous thing that Jerry Seinfeld says about stand-up is, you know, you can do an hour and 10 show that's amazing, but if you do an hour and 20-minute show and the last 10 minutes are terrible, that's all people remember. So you got to keep it short, you know, to keep it to what works, to what's good. You don't have to do that full extra 10 minutes if it's not going to work, you know?
And you start with the end. I know the last 5 or 10 minutes of every keynote I give. Now, it's different with different keynotes. But I'll say to them, you know, they'll give me a countdown clock or whatever. But I'll say, I also want somebody in the front row to put hands on their chest, two open hands for 10 minutes, one open hand for 5. But 10 minutes, I need to wrap up the story I'm now telling. 5 minutes, I need to tell my closing story. I read a conference for the, I don't know, it's the National or American Association of College and University Research Directors. Now, these are not people that do research. They direct the program. So they write the grants and so on. They all used to do research and got tired of it. So they became desk jockeys. Everybody, 600 people, everybody in the room had a PhD.
Oh, my goodness.
Several had more than one. One guy had 6. So I want to meet that guy. I met him. I said, what's the deal? 6? He says, well, he said, only takes me 2 days a week to do my job. So I go to class. I love going to class. I go to class. I get the points. I get the points. I get another degree. And I said, what's the goal? He says, well, my boss has 8. I want to do 9. I said, do 10. Punch him in both noses.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's good. That's good.
And I said, anybody cares? He says, I care. Okay. So I get done, and I'm coming off stage, and the lady who introduced me says, you ended early. You've got 15 more minutes. I said, I thought I had 45 minutes. I said, no, you have an hour. I said, Q&A. She goes up. McNair has graciously consented to do a Q&A. I said, no, I didn't. I ended too early. Let's do a Q&A. So I said, questions. I don't do it that way. I have a question that leads a question. Any questions about the habits of the actively creative mind, which is the subject of the new book? And she stands up and says, the lady stands up and holds up my book, Hatch. I went by your book table, and you didn't look like you had enough books there, so I grabbed one. I left you $20. Is that how much they are? I said, for you, okay, 20. And she said, now on the cover, it says C. McNair Wilson. What does the C stand for? Usually I say the C is silent.
Yeah.
But what I did that day, because it's PhDs, I said, now pay attention. You're all smart folks. The C is for, and moving my index finger in a crescent shape across the side of my stomach, I said, C is for cesarean on my mother's side.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, our time's wrapping up here, but this is so great just to talk with you and hear about your life adventures, especially Imagineering and the books. And I'm going to make sure I put on this podcast when it's on YouTube or the other things where they can find your book and all that. But I want to ask you this, McNair. Can you, you know, some of the people that are listening to this are either younger or not yet established comedians. Probably they're leaning clean in their material. Any words of advice for somebody who's maybe in their, I don't know, 20s, early 30s, about how to proceed with this crazy entertainment life of bringing humor? And
First of all, I would say let's get rid of the clean comedian words.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I'm a 34-year-old guy. I'm married, have a kid. I talk about my family. You know, as our friend Jeff Allen would say, you know, he invented the phrase happy wife, happy life. And he said, you make fun of women. He said, no, I make fun of my wife, period. Jim Gaffigan.
Yeah.
Talks about his wife in fun ways. She helps him write that stuff. Literally. Look at the credits on all his deals.
Right.
She's one of the executive producers. I'd say, tell people, you know, I do my story. I kind of emphasize this. Or I was in the Navy. I talk about that a lot or whatever. The other thing is, just be funny. Be funny. Be funny.
And I hope that sinks into people, to be funny, because that's all, you know, that's what it takes. Because that's what people are coming into, whether it's a nightclub or a church setting or a theater, whatever it is. They're coming there because if it says comedy on the sign out front, they want to come in and laugh. They don't want to come in there and sit through 20 minutes of whatever with no laughter. You know, they're paying money to come and be entertained and for them to enjoy laughing.
Nowhere, anywhere in my PR, my bio that I sent you, my resume, have I ever used or do I use the word comedy, comedian? I might say storyteller.
Yeah.
I might say humorist, you know, but I tell people within 5 minutes, the audience will be laughing heartily.
Right.
And that will not end until I'm done, including probably one of the last two or three things I say. And they'll remember that because people remember what touches them emotionally. So you, and this is what I teach public speaking, make them laugh, move them to tears or a heart, and maybe piss them off.
Right.
Say something that makes them a little uncomfortable if they've got to go, not sure about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the word I use, and I learned this when I was teaching for Ken Davis for years, the objective. What's the objective? Why are you saying this? What do you want people to know, learn, change, try? You know, if you're just giving people information, you might as well just get up and make an announcement. You know, and entertain people, make them glad they came and make them fans, you know, like Chick-fil-A talks about it. I've worked with them for 18 years, raving fans. And that's customers who aren't just regular customers. They're regular customers who bring their friends, who tell their friends, who get people to go there because the food. I was sitting at one of the best restaurants here in town the other night. And we ended up talking about Chick-fil-A. I didn't bring it up. Geez, their food is good. Oh, I love their food. You know, I wanted to, before we finish real quickly, because you mentioned the new book, A Trombone Play Badly. Michael Eisner sat in on my brainstorming class, Hatch class, which in those days we called How to Think Like Walt Disney. And he said, you think you could teach this to Disney execs? And I said, well, I don't know. I've met some of those guys. He said, you don't think they're smart enough? I said, no. The opposite. They're too smart. The hardest thing to teach people is what they think they already know.
Yes. Yes.
And I said, I've met those guys. I've done presentations for them. They're really, really bright. That's why they're the heads of the 23 divisions of Walt Disney. And so, in fact, Disney doesn't say division. They say part of the magic of the Walt Disney Company is what it says on your business card. So they said, well, let's try it. And I'll send a memo out. Want them. And he required every divisional head and their 10 top people, or I don't know if he said 10, but your 10 top. And the very first session, three of the top guys, including a guy who's still in the business, just not at Disney, big movie producer, who was head of Walt Disney Studios, which meant every movie, every TV show, every product that came out with a Disney name on it, that was film or TV, came out under his authority. When we were done with the 7 agreements of brainstorming, saw these three guys, knew all three of them, and they came out, they said, this is great, we want you to teach our team. Of course, the three of us, we're not creative. I said, excuse me? Oh, well, we're not creative. And the one guy who was head of consumer products, that is every household object with a mouse.
Wow.
He was the only VP that Eisner didn't replace when he came in, because he's that good. And I said, Bo, you're terribly creative. I've been in meetings with you. You've used me with your people. He says, well, he said, I can't even draw a straight line. I said, nobody can. That's why every art supply store in the world, go to Aaron Brothers.
Yeah.
Go to Hobby Lobby. What do they have? An entire aisle of T-squares and triangles and rulers.
Right.
And who buys those? Artists. Talented, professional artists. Because nobody can draw a straight
right.
line. It's not a test for anything. I went to the Minneapolis College of Art and Design on a scholarship. They didn't call a week in advance. They said, no, just double checking. You still got your full ride scholarship. But you can draw a straight line, can't you? Didn't matter.
Yeah.
The other guy said, well, I can't draw stick figures. I said, yes, you can. What do you mean? How do you know? I said, because as a kid, you went on a field trip or your church youth group went to the beach. You got on a bus and you sat in the back and you played what? Hangman. He goes, oh, yeah. And you had to draw a stick figure. I said, exactly. But don't worry. Nobody's hiring stick figure drawers. You're safe.
That's great.
And so so I thought, you know what it is? People take the word creativity and they turn it into artistic stuff.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
And that. You know, if I was in Reading and you say, you want to go out to dinner? And I'll say, well, do you own a restaurant?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What is that? What does that
yeah.
mean? And so I thought, how do I convince these guys? So I spent the next year talking to everybody I knew at Imagineering and friends not at Imagineering, friends at other similar companies. I knew I had friends at Universal because I went and did several projects with Universal after I left there. I created something that became what the world now knows as Seuss Landing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And you know, Universal. Yeah, they handed me a box of every Dr. Seuss book, and they said, do something with this. And I said, what? They said, we don't know. And I designed this thing that I couldn't talk about because of non-disclosure agreements for 6 years.
Wow.
Because they didn't know what to do
wow.
with it until they came up with Islands of Adventure. Anyway, so I thought, okay, what is crazy? And I came down after a year of doing that, including my dad, who couldn't match a shirt and tie. And this is not just a joke. Couldn't match a shirt and tie to save his life.
Yeah.
He had to get permission from me or my mom. My brother didn't care. To leave the house every morning in his suit and tie because he thought this tie and that thing would go together. They didn't. Of course, then the 80s came and he was a fashion exclamation
right,
point.
Exactly.
But,
yeah, right, exactly. Yeah,
you know, so I came up with all these things and it boiled down to four or five habits of the most actively creative people. And that's the word I use instead of saying creative and non-creative. Because nobody raised their hand and said, well, I'm not creative. Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Children, anthropologists, in every society they've gone into, in the farthest non-technological bush, Africa and Central America, children by age 3, they say, are fully creatively expressed. They're telling stories. They're making up songs. They're playing. They're doing all these things before they have reading and writing skills. They're doing that. How do they do
yeah.
that? It's their natural, what I call factory-installed creative spirit.
Mm.
Everybody has that. And we don't accept that. So the new book, A Trombone Played Badly, is to prove that you have that you do take risks, that you do challenge assumptions, that you do see things differently, that you are endlessly curious. Those four habits are in all of us. We just don't realize that when we cut off the highway to take a shortcut home, it's our creative mind saying, this could be better, this could be different. Now, Often, the shortcut is neither faster nor shorter in distance, but it's you solving a problem, and you feel friggin' great about yourself.
Yes, yes. As you're talking about that concept of creativity in your latest book, I'm thinking that sounds like something that comedians, myself included, need to read, because it's not a book about how to write a joke and how to perform the joke and how to, you know, find gigs as a comedian. It's about the heart of it, which is, as you have so eloquently said, creativity. It's finding that thing inside of you that gives birth to whatever it is, comedy, music, you know, acting, painting, whatever it is, you know.
A good comedian points to things that you have done. I saw a comedian the other night on TV, did a whole riff on Starbucks. I go to Starbucks all the time. And he really had it nailed.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? He's got it.
Yeah.
A good comedian makes you think, I never thought of it that way. I never. And the title, real quickly,
yeah.
Walt Disney admitted as a kid, and his brother would tell you the story, and his nephew, who I knew, Roy Jr., even though Roy Jr. had a different middle initial than his dad, they called him Roy Jr., that Roy or Walt ran away with the circus. Hence, all the circus stuff throughout
Disney. That makes sense, yeah.
There was going to be, where the Matterhorn is in Disneyland, there was going to be a daily operating circus.
Uh-huh.
And they had it outside at Holiday Land next to it, where Pirates now is. Anyway, Walt ran away and joined the circus as a kid. Well, he tells the story, and in any article you find in a Parents magazine, Educators magazine, or a keynote address that Walt did, and my boss Marty wrote a lot of these, and so he showed me some of these. And in all of them, there was this little five-line story about a kid who wanted to be in the circus, been planning it all his life. Finally, 8 or 9 years old, he goes, the circus comes to town, he goes and asks the owner of the circus. And the circus says, well, the owner said, the only thing we've got is a trombone player. Guy got sick. Kid says, trombone, that's my deal, trombone. Now, I do this as the opening of my TED Talk. I do it as the opening of my most of my keynotes and so on. When I do an all-day workshop called the Curiosity Tour, I was determined not to call an all-day workshop something-something creativity, because the people that need to be there won't come.
Right.
They will self-unselect. I'm not creative. Why would I go to that workshop? Do you have a curiosity? Yes. Then you'll fit in. Not until the next day, opening day parade, as the whole circus performers are rumbling past, and finally at the end, the circus band. And from the middle of the band, the brass section, you hear these horrible screeching, what I call cat choking sounds. And the owner of the circus leaps from the reviewing stand, jumps in the street, fights through the sea of blue uniforms, grabs the trombone from the newest member of the band, says, son, why didn't you tell me you couldn't play the trombone? Well, golly, sir, I didn't know. I'd never tried it before.
That's great.
That was Walt's story. And in that story, you have take a risk, challenge the assumption that an eight-year-old, nine-year-old kid couldn't see things differently, see the circus by being in the circus.
Yeah.
And stay curious. What would it like to be in the circus?
Yeah.
And so the new book is A Trombone Played Badly. And the subtitle is Life at Full Blast.
Oh, I like that.
And so,
that's nice.
Yeah.
It reminded me so much of when I got to high school. I was a bass player growing up, a string bass player. And I got to high school and I signed up for band, not even thinking or knowing about marching band, you know. And so I said, well, I play bass. They go, you can't play that in the marching band. I said, okay. And they said, what else do you play? And I saw a French horn down on the floor. I said, oh, I play that. And I had no idea. So I picked it up and basically, you know, messed my way through a French horn for that year that I was in marching band, marching the Rose Parade and all that. But I had no idea how to play that thing. I just played it by ear as best as I could.
Which instrument has the smallest mouthpiece on the planet? Give me that one.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's great. Well, McNair, it has been great talking with you. It's always great talking with you, but it's been great for our listeners, and I hope I'm sure they gleaned some wisdom and insight into what are the possible pathways for a creative person. And we only scratched the surface in this, you know, 50 minutes together.
Well, the new book, Trombone, will be out probably in March. It's done. I'm done writing it. I'm just putting a final polish on it, which is not editing, just me going through it. I gave the book to three friends who had never heard me speak or do a workshop, and they just know me. And I wanted to see if the book worked on its own, because so many books out there by speakers, when I first started doing corporate speaking while I was still at Disney, they were transcripts of people's keynotes. A, their keynotes sucked, and B, they didn't edit the transcript. And they were unreadable. And I tell people, you know, first of all, edit it. Get somebody to edit it who doesn't care about you, who cares about the English language. So anyway, but all my books, if people just go to Amazon, put in C. McNair Wilson, all my books, Hatch is the only one that's technically still in print, but they're all available on Amazon. Somebody's got used copies.
Yeah. So Trombone is coming out, what'd you say, March?
That's the target.
Okay, cool.
I mean, I'm turning it over to the it's self-published like Hatch is, and the team that did it, the Book Village group that creates books for folks that, you know, we had 18 rejections on Hatch.
Wow.
And my literary agent was the editor-in-chief at Moody Press for years, the second largest Christian publisher. He said, McNair, there's no reason for this thing not to get published. Get it out there. And so I found these guys, Book Villages, fantastic. They let me, you know, illustrate it, design the cover, all kinds of. When I first posted the cover on Facebook, people said, you can't do a black book cover. I said, watch me. Since it's come out, no one has ever mentioned that the cover is black. It's not. It's bright, big, bold, bright graphic fonts.
Yeah.
And the background happens to be black.
Right. That's funny.
And it works great. In fact, I was praying about it as I was traveling. And I said, God, give me a clear sign. I'm supposed to do a black book cover or not. And there's a bookstore in the middle of the United Airlines wing of O'Hare Airport, a place I never go. Unless I'm going to Chicago, I will not go to O'Hare. People are born, live, and die in the O'Hare terminal. And I was in the bookstore, and through the window, because it's this box, this glass box of books, and I saw at the back of it this book, and it was a black cover. I thought, what the heck? And I went back and I grabbed it. Well, it's a guy who's done all kinds of fun stuff, and it was just his handwriting and so on, and it was black, and it became a bestseller, and he's done two or three other books since. And I thought, I'm doing a black cover. Well, when everybody saw it just as a little postage stamp on Facebook, you know, that's what they saw. So, but the new cover, just to relieve everybody's anxiety, the new cover, book cover is white. Ooh,
Yeah, you took quite a leap there. That's good.
I've already started the third book in the series. I've got a list of 7 books I want to do in this series.
Oh, wow.
And a friend of mine, Richard Lederer, has written 60 books on language. Brilliant stuff. He says he's an unrepentant verbivore. And he's just brilliant. And we met at a conference together. And I called him and I said, Richard, I said, what is a word like the word trilogy, but for a series of 4 books? Because I think Hatch is going to be 4 books. And he said, there isn't really a good word. There's quadrille. If you do a series of four operas, it's a quartet. And I said, nah, no more. And he said, well, what have you been telling me? I said, I tell people I'm doing a 4-book trilogy. He said, given you your sense of humor, he said, stick with that.
I like that.
And then he reminded me that my friend, Madeline Lengel, who's no longer with us, when she wrote A Wrinkle in Time, was rejected by 26 publishers.
Wow.
When it finally got published in the early 60s, became a bestseller. It is still in print from that original publisher. It's been in 100-plus languages. When they were picking the best books of the 20th century, the best children's books of the 20th century were Charlotte's Web, Chronicles of Narnia, 6 volumes seen as one story, mm-hmm. and A Wrinkle in Time.
Wow.
26 rejections. Well, yeah. She went on years later, wrote several other books, and then she came back and wrote 2 books that became sequels to A Wrinkle in Time, which she had not even thought of all those years before. So it became the Wrinkle Trilogy. More books, several years more, 2 more books.
Wow.
In that series. Well, there are 5 now, but it's still called the Wrinkle Trilogy.
Yeah, but it has 5 books. Okay.
Exactly.
Cool.
Because the theme is the same. So this will be the Hatch Trilogy. And what we're going to do, Hatch doesn't have that now, but when we do the next printing, on the spine at the bottom will be a little number 1. On Trombone, there'll be a little number 2, and so on.
Nice. Nice. Well, McNair, it's been great having you here. I've loved all the insights and wisdom, and I know that people that are listening to this, anybody that listens is going to know you are a creative guy. I was going to use the word genius, but I don't want to make you feel weird, but, you know, a creative genius here that I've been able to talk with, and all the stuff you've been involved with has just been amazing. And I hope you guys get a chance to check out these books. You know, go check out Hatch. Go check out his other books, if you can find them in print, and the ones that are coming. And just connect yourself with this man, because you are going to glean creativity in what McNair has to tell you. It's been great having you with us, McNair. I hope you have a great rest of the day. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad we've stayed in touch over the decades.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with C. McNair Wilson. Remember, the C is silent. Sharing his insights and his adventures on his long path he's been on with Disney Imagineering and all the conferences he's done and companies he's worked with. And, of course, his insights into the world of creativity. If you're anybody in the arts, a comedian, an artist, a magician, a singer, whatever it is, an actor, you need to really check out his books. The one that's most recently released is Hatch, Brainstorming, Secrets of a Theme Park Designer. And then his upcoming book, to be released in March, is A Trombone Played Badly. And again, that's another great book on creativity. Hey, if you like this podcast, make sure you subscribe to wherever you're getting your podcast from. Tell your friends about it. Until next time, this is Dan McGowan, and this has been Just Pure Laughs.